Okay, did you hear that? Okay, so the comment was about how she finds she has to make a lot of choices in her life, and that she's accustomed to doing that, has been accustomed to doing that on the basis of emotions, but now, say she's doing metta practice, loving kindness practice, and she's finding more distance, more space from her emotions. But there's not an inner voice, like an inner Buddha, telling her, well, choose this and not that. So what to do? She's kind of in no man's land in between the two. Be happy. I think that's actually a good place, and it is a place in process. You're not going to stay there, you know. I think what emerges, not everyone has a clear, intuitive voice. It just doesn't happen that way. But we, for everybody, but we have the voice of wisdom, which can serve us in some way. If we are about to do something and wisdom tells us, well, the last 15 times I chose in that direction, it really was a mistake. That's a clue. You know, and we say that to ourselves without judgment and without disparagement, but it's insight. It sort of, it reminds me a little way of, I probably used this example the last time I was in England teaching, because it used to be my favorite example of mindfulness. And this was from an article I read in the New York Times many years ago now, about a pilot program in school, pilot meaning testing program in school, in a fifth grade classroom in Oakland, California. So the kids were like 10 years old, something like that. And they were, these trainers were bringing in some mindfulness skills into this classroom. And in this article, it was altogether a very nice article in the Times, but there were two quotations I especially liked in it. One was from one of the researchers who said, all day long we tell kids to pay attention, but we never tell them how. And the other quotation was from one of the kids, so he's like 10 years old, and they say to him, what is mindfulness? What is mindfulness? And he replied by saying, mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. That's what mindfulness means. And I thought, great answer. That's a great answer. And for a while was my favorite definition of mindfulness. Mindfulness means not hitting someone in the mouth. Because what does that imply? It implies knowing we're feeling angry when we start to feel angry. Not after it's built and escalated. Not after we've hit someone in the mouth. Not after we've gone to the computer and typed out the email and pressed send. But as it's starting to bubble up, it also implies a certain balanced relationship to the anger, because if we get lost in it, overwhelmed by it, overcome by it, clearly we will hit a lot of people in the mouth. But at the same time, if we hate it and we fear it and we can't bring ourselves to acknowledge it's there and we're all uptight, we're going to get tighter and tighter and tighter, and then we'll explode. So mindfulness is like a way, it's a place in the middle, so that we can acknowledge what's there, we can connect to what's there, but we're not going to either extreme. And in that space, because it creates some space, we might remember, oh, you know, last week I hit someone in the mouth. It didn't work out that well. Let me try this. Let me try that. So it's kind of like that. When we have space, we have options, we have wisdom helping us choose amongst the options. And, you know, it's life wisdom. It's learning from our mistakes, learning from what we believe to be true. even without that kind of clear voice that says, do this, don't do that. And, you know, it may not be that clear that we want to take a vacation here compared to taking a vacation there. It may be much clearer that hurting people doesn't bring us happiness. Something like that. And so we return to that kind of wisdom when we have a choice. It also reminds me of, as I said yesterday, the phrases I was given in Burma in my loving kindness practice, again, beginning with oneself, were, may I be free from danger, may I be free from mental suffering, may I be free from physical suffering, may I have ease of well-being, or may I live with ease. And so those were the four phrases that I used for my practice, which was like 3 months long, and it was great. It was wonderful. It was transformative. And as I said yesterday, when I came back and started teaching in California, people didn't like that phrasing, you know, repeating danger and suffering and so on. So that's why we tend to do it differently. But anyway, I had a tremendous time using those phrases, but I didn't really like the fourth phrase for a long time. I liked, may I be free from mental suffering, a lot. But that fourth phrase, may I live with ease, or may I have ease of well-being, it seems so petty to me, so trivial, especially compared to the intensity and the gravitas of the others. But, you know, there I was doing my practice, so I just kept using it and using it and using it. And one day it was like something shifted inside of me, and I thought, wow, we have so many choices and so many decisions and sometimes so many crazy moral dilemmas. Our lives are so complicated. I thought, may I live with ease? That's my favorite phrase. And I told this story once, and my friend, in contrast to me, my friend who used to work for the federal government in Washington, D.C., she's very recently retired. She loved that phrase, may I live with ease. And she decided that was going to be her, kind of her moral compass. That when she had choices to make, she had decisions to make, things were going to have to pass the may I live with ease test. So I told that story, and another friend of mine is an artist, and she made me a stamp that says something like, does this pass the may I live with ease test? So my first friend who worked for the federal government heard about the stamp, and I lent it to her. She really wanted it. So for these years, and it was several years that she was still working, she would kind of randomly stamp documents. Does this pass the may I live with ease test? And, you know, as I told the story the other day in Oxford or somewhere, and I thought, oh, she did just retire. I should get my stamp back. You know, so that's a pretty good basis in which to think, huh, this or that. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Falling into the jaws of overwhelm. Well, I think it works in both directions. There are ways we can build resiliency, and then there are ways we can fall and then get out. You know, and both really happen. We build resiliency in a lot of different ways. Sometimes it's through balance. And it's actually not a bad exercise, like when I've worked with people in caretaking professions that are extremely stressful, like we, through this place called the Garrison Institute in Garrison, New York, we did a 4 or 5 year program working with frontline workers in domestic violence shelters. You know, so it was extremely stressful and difficult. We were bringing tools of yoga and meditation. And the first exercise we usually did was we'd ask people to write down in one column, because this is all about work, right? But it could be bigger than that. Write down what are the particular stressors at work, things that really are difficult. And then in another column, write down what do you tend to do for resiliency, for bouncing back, for finding balance. And then if they wanted to, in a third column, some assessment, like how they really feel about some of these things that they were doing. And then anybody who wanted to was invited to read their lists out loud. And, you know, the stressors were pretty common and the same. There were some great commonality and some big differences in what people did to try to find some balance. A lot of people used music. For some people, it was religion. It was different kinds of music, very different kinds of music. Some people, it was nature, which was interesting because we were right in the middle of New York City. They were right in the middle of New York City in their work. Some people wrote down drinking, which they were worried about, things like that. And then I remember one woman, she was reading her list out loud, and she said, "I watch an awful lot of American Idol." I don't know what the British equivalent is. I'm sure there is one. And I said, "I can't believe you do that for relief." So that show stresses me out so much. It's like, for me, it's like watching constant rejection. You know, what about that poor person? They got rejected. But that was like the platform. That's where we started. And we, of course, were saying, well, here are some things you can try. Let's see if at the end of this period of time you want to add these tools. You know, so I think that helps, actually, taking a look at what we do and having a pretty honest assessment. We need balance. That's the first thing, is understanding that it's not superficial. It's not selfish. It's not self-centered. There needs to be a kind of balance between compassion for ourselves and compassion for others. One of the great slogans in a way that came out of that program we did at Garrison was, first thing, you know, we had many frontline workers come and they were really getting a lot from the program. And so then we had managers and directors and supervisors calling us saying, well, couldn't we have a program too? So then we kind of went up the hierarchy to executive directors. And somewhere around the manager, director, supervisor level, the women evolved this slogan where they said they wanted to help develop a culture of wellness at work. And each of them looked at what they might do. It varied from growing a rooftop garden. I mean, there's so many different things. And always involved meditation at this point. Some kind of space for meditation. But one woman said, "I've resolved to have a lunch break." And all of us who were not working in domestic violence shelters looked at her aghast and said, "Don't you take a lunch break? Aren't you entitled in your contract to a lunch break?" And she said, "Oh, sure, I'm entitled to it, but I never have time to take it." So then she resolved that this was going to be her effort to take a lunch break. So She would report in subsequent meetings. So she came in once and she said it didn't work. I locked the door, but somebody crouched down and looked through the keyhole. So I had to let him in. And then she came back a later week and she said it worked. She said, I locked the door and turned off the lights. And it worked. You know, but even thinking that's okay is very hard for us. Somehow we think we're obliged to go and go and go and give and give and give, and that it's going to be sustainable, and it's not sustainable. So even that knowledge, that wisdom is very important. It's not selfish to realize I need to build resiliency. I need to create some balance. That's the only way that either this effort can go on or I can pick myself up out of, you know, that state of being so overwhelmed. And so it'll vary. You know, for a lot of people, it can be some kind of meditation practice, something that connects us to something bigger than the immediate situation and its stressors can be a tremendous thing. But definitely something, you know, that will bring a kind of balance that will include ourselves and not just leave ourselves out. Yeah, so that's a great question. The question was, let's say you're a writer and your friend asks you, or this person asks your friend, right, asks you all about the next book you're writing, and you tell them all your ideas and how you're laying it out and what your plan is for the book, and then they at one point ask to meet your publisher and have your contacts, and you're happy you introduce them to all these people, and then the next thing you know, they tell you they're writing a book themselves and you're all excited for them, and you ask them what it is, and it turns out it's your book, and they've stolen your ideas, and then they put their book out, it's number one on the bestseller list. Should you have sympathetic joy for them? And it does happen, you're right. And I mean, I know people, not a few people, not just a few people, I know some number of people who actually will not tell anyone what they're working on for that reason. And I find that kind of sad, you know, that this is the nature of things. No, I mean, that question comes up in different forms. Like if somebody is making a ton of money, you know, destroying the earth, should I have sympathetic joy for their having made all this money, or, you know, if they're causing harm, if they've in effect stolen from you? No, I mean, that's not the time to have sympathetic joy. Sympathetic joy doesn't mean we lose discernment, we lose intelligence. You may not want to be completely overwhelmed by the pain of that moment, because then what usually happens is that we stay there stuck with the pain and they're going to go on, you know. But that's a different question. But no, I think sympathetic joy is more, we want to work with the challenge of not feeling sympathetic joy more in situations where it's our own stuckness. You know, somebody's living a perfectly happy life, but not in the way we have decided they should live. You know, can we let go of our opinion? And they're not harming anybody. They're not doing anything that's kind of morally off, but it's just not our idea, not our image. And so can we let go of that opinion and just be happy for them? I once had this experience where I went to India one year, India and Nepal, and met different teachers along the way with a whole group of people I was traveling with, and when I got back to the States, one of the people who was a young man came to me and said, you know, I've been thinking about going back to India to see this one guru that we'd gone to visit and bringing my father. He said, my father has never done anything like this, remotely like this before in his life. But I want to bring him there to meet this guru. What do you think? And I said, you know, I don't think it's such a good idea. India has so many extraordinarily beautiful places, and that city is not one of them. It's going to be hot. Maybe he'll get sick. He might hate the food. It's like a bad season to go. And not only that, I mean, you have to admit, the scene around the guru is pretty strange. And he's never remotely done anything like this before. He might get completely turned off to all kinds of spiritual practice altogether. And I said, I don't think you should go. So he didn't listen to me, and he brought his father anyway. So the next time I saw him, sometime later in the States, I said, how was it? And he said, it was the best thing I've ever done in my entire life. My father loved India. He loved everything about India. He loved the city. He loved the food. Not only that, he loved the guru. He loved the scene around the guru. And not only that, he became a disciple of the guru. And not only that, he's decided to devote the rest of his life to promoting the guru's teaching. So I stood there and I thought, I could not have been more wrong. And there was this moment where I thought, am I going to fume because they had a good time? Despite my advice, my well-considered, intelligent advice, or am I going to be happy for them? So that's like more the moment, our own view, our own opinion, our need to be right, all these things that stand in the way. That's when we really want to be working with the challenge of sympathetic joy, not, you know, letting go of discernment and wisdom. And if you are, in fact, a writer and that wasn't a hypothetical question, I really wish you great good luck. I don't know where that... So the question was about offering loving kindness or compassion to someone who's harming other people, and how very, very difficult that is. And it is very, very difficult. It's true. Part of what's difficult, of course, is that we all need to continue to grow and develop in our understanding of what loving kindness and compassion is and what they're not. Because it's not meant to be this kind of lazy accolade, like, fine, you know, keep doing what you're doing, or doesn't matter after all, you know, I forgive you, in a shallow kind of way. It's not like that, but it seems like that to us. And so it's a whole big process to go deeper and deeper and deeper into those states. Because to offer loving kindness, I mean, compassion would probably be more the case to someone who's harming other people does not in any way mean that we're hoping for them to triumph in their terrible behavior. Part of it is sometimes born out of realizing that if we are just lost in hatred all the time, we are suffering so much. And we want to find another way of being. Part of it is kind of, it's like the poignancy of choices people make. If you do believe that everybody, without exception, has this tremendous potential for wisdom and for love, and then we see how people can live their lives and the choices, you know, terrible choices sometimes at a very young age, that actually determines so much of the rest of someone's life. And you think, wow, this precious, precious life, and look what you did, you know? It's very poignant. There's also a certain level of understanding where you know, we see it in ourselves as well. We see causes and conditions coming together for things to be a certain way. In the Buddhist cosmology, which believes very strongly in rebirth, you know, as a cosmology, which is different than the meditation practices, time is said to be beginningless. And within that worldview, we have all died and been reborn and died and been reborn countless infinite times. And so all of us sitting here in this room together right now have all done everything with one another and to one another. We've been one another's children and parents, and we've hurt one another and saved one another over and over again. So I've often thought from that worldview, the single most illogical feeling one could have or reaction one could have is one of self-righteousness, as though to say, I, who am immaculate, way over here, I'm looking at you way down there. You've done this horrible thing I could never, ever, ever do. Because guess what? You've done it. And certainly that doesn't mean it doesn't matter or that you won't take very strong action to protect somebody, or you don't think that action is that bad. You know, it could be terrible. And you might do everything to try to stop somebody from doing it again. But that feeling like I'm so perfect and you're like so low, it doesn't make sense in that particular model of the universe. And so, and certainly not everyone feels any kind of resonance with that model, and it doesn't really matter. I also don't think it takes such a huge amount of introspection to notice how much rage, how much fear, how much desire, all kinds of stuff comes up. I used to say, and I understand we're getting kind of somewhat close, I wanted someone to invent a machine that would amplify people's thoughts. And then we would take one person per meditation session and we put it on. And the rest of us could just listen. It'd be very interesting, wouldn't it? Wow, you look so peaceful. Who could have known? That's what was going on inside your head. And I hear, you know, because I've said this a lot, and neuroscientists have told me, we're getting closer. But in the absence of that, I sometimes say, wouldn't it be cool to take one sort of volunteer per session, meditation session, and have them act out every impulse that comes up in their mind? That would be interesting too. You know, so it's not that we do act out every impulse that comes up in our minds, sometimes because of our backgrounds, our education, our understanding, our training, sometimes because of sheer good luck. I bet everybody in this room, if we really thought about it, could remember a time when it was like saved by the bell, right? And so, still, when we look at somebody who's done something terrible, it's not quite with this feeling that I'm so perfect and you're so awful, even though we likely never actually do what they did. There's a kind of almost an understanding that, oh yeah, I could see how one might, given other conditions. And so there's just a certain, it's poignant, but it's connected, you know, rather than alienated. And that's what I think really develops. I think also going back to the model that I presented of motivation and skillful execution, that part is really helpful, because to have a certain different understanding of somebody or deeper understanding of somebody doesn't mean necessarily you're going to want any contact with them or you're going to want to see them roaming about the streets. You know, it doesn't determine the action that might feel appropriate. And that's reassuring because it's scary to think about, I'm just going to let anybody do anything. And, you know, and that's what compassion means. And it's not what it means. You know, so that's also a part of it. So maybe by the time I come back to England, your friend will be a card-carrying Buddhist. Although we don't carry cards, but we'll do something. Is there a practice to be free of judgment? Yes. Both practices, mindfulness and loving kindness, will help. Mindfulness helps in that we really don't have to worry, from that vantage point, we really don't have to worry about eradicating the judgment. We just have to see it. It's like that kid seeing his anger. We need to notice it before it kind of sneaks up and has us disparage somebody to somebody else or something like that. To be able to see it and kind of have it pass through. It's sort of like the weather. And so, and we can do that. We just get more and more mindful. And then, and what's, you know, sometimes it sounds a little harsh, like you're going to give yourself a lecture and you're going to be this goody-goody. And, but it's not like that. It's actually like, oh, yeah, there it goes, you know. So mindfulness will do that. And loving kindness will do that just because there's a kind of poignancy, you know, there's just a kind of sympathy in a way to realize, yeah, it's kind of hard actually having a human life. And look at that. Yeah. There's some, I mean, mindfulness, everything can be done in so many different styles, but there was some teacher who suggested counting your judgmental thoughts, which could add up in a session, not to make you feel bad, but just to get a little distance from them. So unless, you know, instead of like being all involved in them, you're kind of going 1, 2, 3, 8, you know, just like on and on. So maybe it's time to do my plug for regular practice, unless someone else has a question or comment. I'll plug regular practice. Please practice. And the last comment I made me think of that, because the question usually does come up, which practice? Because over time, people tend to learn a few and have some choices, and I really honestly think it could be anything. And sometimes people will divide a session and do maybe loving kindness practice in the beginning, do some mindfulness practice, or do loving kindness practice at the end as a kind of affirmation that our inner work is never really just for ourselves alone. As I said yesterday, when I went to Burma in 1985, to do 3 months of loving-kindness practice, that was the beginning of a 4-year period in which that was my practice. Each day, whether I was on retreat or sitting at home, mostly my practice these days is mindfulness practice, and as I said yesterday, I have a resolve to do loving-kindness practice every time I'm waiting, and I count all modes of transportation as waiting. So walking down the streets of New York or sitting on the airplane or whatever it is, I try to do loving kindness practice. So there are lots of ways of doing it. The hard part is actually doing it rather than just thinking about it. But if you can create some kind of support structure, whether it's having others to practice with at least sometimes or having a regular schedule, or even as I said somewhere, my friend Joseph Goldstein took this resolve one day that for a period of time, he wasn't going to go to bed at night until he'd at least gotten into the sitting posture. So that was like a 30-second commitment. And he did it. So it's great. You know, sometimes he said it was just that. It would be the last thing he'd do at night. But he did it. You know, so we each find our ways of finding that support and helping create and sustain that support. But it's really important if you want to pursue this practice. And I often say, too, it's too bad, really. It's not just theoretical. It'd be so much easier. We're kind of used to that. But yeah, like, I appreciate that from a distance. Good, it's done. But it's not like that. And so finding a way to really persist is really very, very helpful and important. I'll also add one thing, which is it's important not to judge the quality of your practice, because it will go up and down. Sometimes you'll be calm, sometimes you'll be sleepy, sometimes you'll be angry, sometimes you'll be joyful. It will always change. But over time, you will see that you're different in your life. You have a greater ability to let go of things, to start over, to forgive yourself, to be kind to others, to pay attention, you know, to strangers. I mean, all kinds of things will shift even as your practice is going up and down. And so that's another important thing. So why don't we close just with a very brief sharing of the merit and loving kindness to guide you through, and then we'll just have the last announcement. So sharing of the merit is another concept. The idea is that when we do something toward the good, when we're kind, when we're generous, when we're restrained, like it would be awfully easy to tell a lie and we don't, when we meditate, even if you feel the quality of your meditation is not that great, doesn't matter. It's the fact that you sat down to do it. When we try to learn, when we investigate, when we seek understanding, all of this is considered a very positive energy. It generates a very positive energy. That's the merit. It's almost like a moral force, this energy. And so it's very common at the end of something like a retreat to dedicate or offer that merit to others. But we start with just appreciating it. There are lots of ways of spending a Sunday or a weekend. You chose to come here. You're interested in your life. You don't want to just live mechanically. You're willing to take some risks. You practice. You start over and over and over again. That's a very powerful force, actually, a very powerful positive force. And you can enjoy it. That's not the same as conceit or arrogance. It's really a great source of delight. And then we offer that power, that force, with those who've helped us be here. They've taken care of us here. Or maybe they've taken care of things at home so we can be here. Or they inspired us long ago. Just whoever comes to mind. And in your own words, you can silently say something like, I share the power of my practice with you. I share the merit of my practice with you. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. And those whom you know are hurting, are struggling. And share the merit of our practice with one another. And with all beings everywhere. So thank you all so much. May you be happy and peaceful. And thank you, London Insight, which is everywhere around the room.